afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darton, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, a documentary about Oakland activists who travel throughout California after being inspired by Octavia Butler. Then our interviews from the Bay Area Book Festival. One is with an Oakland author who writes about social issues and Latinx horror. The other is a children's book author who co-wrote a story about a little girl not wanting to move from her grandparents' home. Today's show is about survival and caring for each other. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darton. Decades ago, legendary sci-fi writer Octavia Butler foresaw what was to come of our country and planet. Down to the year, she warned readers in her novel, Parables of the Sower. But one group is looking to Butler's book as a guide on how to build caring communities and survive in times like today. People's Kitchen Collective in Oakland is an organization that does work at the intersection of art, social justice, and food. And in the documentary Earthseed, A People's Journey of Radical Hospitality, the group travels on the trail from the Parables book, and they go from Pasadena to Mendocino County. Along the way, they break bread with people of color in rural and urban areas who establish communities where care and survival are a priority. Now, here's a clip of Sita Bamik, one of the org's co-founders, reflecting on their purpose.
Food for us is a lens to understand the world. Everything exists out there, and our job as artists is to connect the dots, to help ourselves see a constellation. And the purpose of a constellation is that it helps you navigate. It helps you see a path forward. And I think that's what we're all seeking.
Earthseed will be screening at BAMFA in Berkeley on Sunday, July 27th. And joining me today is Jocelyn Jackson. She is a co-founder of People's Kitchen Collective and chef in residence at the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco. Welcome, Jocelyn.
Thank you so much. It's beautiful to be here.
I am really excited to hear this film. Is visually is beautiful, and a lot of things came up for me when I was watching this film. But first, I want to set the tone and actually start our discussion, Jocelyn, with Octavia Butler's voice. So here's an interview from the year 2000 with Octavia Butler at Balticon. I guess that's how you say it, which is a sci-fi convention in Baltimore.
Your work often deals with urban societies. How do you see the future of America's cities?
Oh my. I have no idea how to answer that. I suppose I could tell you to take a look at Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents. Now, that isn't prophecy, I hope. The society that I portray in these two books is pretty much broken. People are living, the people who are surviving with any decency at all are living in walled communities and risking their lives whenever they go out. There are a lot of reasons for this. Drugs, of course, and deterioration of public education, the environmental situation, global warming is practically a character in Parable of the Sower. Lots of other things that have simply, they're problems now, they become disasters because they're not attended to. And I hope, of course, that we will be smarter than that.
Are you a pessimist or an optimist?
I'm hopeful.
All right, so some of the things she named back then in 2000, we're dealing with looking at decrease in quality of education, climate change, really being a big character in our lives right now. Jocelyn, when you read Parables of the Sower, what did you think after reading it?
Oh, I'm glad we start with that question because I've never heard that specific audio clip, but it resonates so deeply with my first impression of the read of Parable of the Sower. Because as she said there, she is not a prophet. That's not the writing she does or she did. Look at me present tensing her. She is someone who looked at present day and extrapolated from current circumstances into the future. Yeah. That's very different from trying to write a speculative fiction book, right?
Right.
It's saying the truth in a future-oriented way. And that's what my impression was about Parable of the Sower.
Yeah.
I love books that offer an opportunity for me to exercise my own instincts about what's going on in the world with a clarity and a truth and a realism that makes me inspired to do that thing where once you knew, what did you do? And I'm so grateful for instructions from ancestors that are like that, that say, you know what, this is what I project could be an outcome of the many outcomes that we have as human beings on this earth. And if you pay attention, this could change. If you don't, it will not.
Right. And I think I can't remember if I read in an interview, I watched an old interview where she said, I'm not a prophet, I just pay attention.
Exactly. Yeah,
that's what she said.
That's what, and I think when she says that, she's calling on all of us to do the same.
Right. To pay attention.
Don't get distracted by the possibilities of the world that our conjecture, our the world for us is a real place and we can see it with real fresh clear eyes if we choose to. And it's only with that version of wokeness that we actually make the shifts that are required. Because I don't know if you saw this article from David Suzuki recently, who is one of the environmental scientists that I have respected and looked at, their work for over a decade. He's saying the quiet part out loud now. Many scientists are absolutely mortified by where we are. And he said clearly and distinctly, it's too late. I don't see that as a pessimistic view, right? I don't see that as a pessimistic view. I think actually Octavia would appreciate that saying of the quiet part out loud. So it orients us to where we need to go. That doesn't mean that we're over. It means that we have an opportunity to respond to reality and in a way that is really speaking to what's real in the world and not being afraid of it and not trying to ignore it. Keep going.
And that's what, you know, that's what I found interesting about the documentary Earthseed, A People's Journey of Radical Hospitality. And Earthseed in the book Parables is a religion and a community that was started by the main character, Lauren Alamina. And so, you know, in this film, we're talking about a bleak time. First of all, again, the film is visually beautiful. The food in the film is great. The people just make you feel at home. And there's some words that come up in the film. You know, I was like, oh, my vocabulary is expanding. let's start with just in the title, Earthseed, A People's Journey of Radical Hospitality. What is radical hospitality?
Thank you for saying that. And it really is important. As you know, that's another thing that Octavia put a lot of attention to, and so did the Black Panther Party. Language matters. How we use it, how we perceive it, how we make sure that it's telling our story from us, by us. And so when we were talking about, one, People's Kitchen Collective and our social practice as artists, as well as this project, we orient toward this phrase, radical hospitality, very intentionally, because hospitality is something that I think all of us understand what it is from our own perspectives. We can get into what that definition is. But when we call that radical, what does it mean? And I love that you started with Sita, because at the end of the film, she actually shares something very important about that definition, which is that radical hospitality is that you're risking something. Mm-hmm. And more often than not, you're risking change.
Right.
As Octavia shared with us, change is the most consistent thing, the most reliable thing. But if you're risking change, the stakes are high. It's the unknown, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you practice risking change, you get into a place of maybe not comfort, but at absolutely familiarity. And so radical hospitality to us is about relationships. It's about reciprocity. It's about really remembering all of this indigenous knowledge and wisdom and really the opportunity for us to get in right relationship with the world around us in a way that is pulling at the roots, as they describe radical in other traditions, including the Black Panthers. Get at the root of a thing. Don't be scared. Go straight to it. Embrace the change that's required to be radical in this moment.
And to care for people, right? Like this radical hospitality
100%.
Is deeply about caring, which is funny because when I heard the term and I was like, you know, my grandparents are from the South. They're from Mississippi and Texas.
Yes.
And it's like, you know, we're talking about radical hospitality or radical caring, you know, however you want to phrase it. And I'm like, these are mm-hmm. things they used to do, right? Taking care of folks, checking in on them. You know, when people come over, I always have something ready to eat and so we can gather and commune. And
that was a habit.
And that was
a
habit.
It was just what you did.
Right. Right.
And that's, I think that's also the point is that, and when we were in each region that we visited, we also reached out to Indigenous communities specifically to ask permission to be there and to also be in this conversation about what radical hospitality is. One of the comments we got was, hospitality is radical for you all. It's not for us.
Okay.
our posture in life is that habit. Right?
Right.
We have forgotten in some ways how to care for one another deeply. And that loss of that muscle of caring deeply for one another in a reciprocal way as a habit is something that we need to renew in one of the call to actions of this film. It's not any clearer that I can get than to say, what is it that we need to do right now to ensure the survival of one another, because we are absolutely bound up with one another in this present circumstances of you know, whether it's climate change, political turmoil, you know, all of these factors. If we don't see that interconnection and we don't have that reciprocity of care, that's a failure at the start, as opposed to being able to navigate survival together.
And you know, again, like I said, you know, we're going through tough times.
Yeah.
And we're kind of just in the beginning stages, I think. And so it's, this film gave me some hope about how we can, you know, we can all work mm-hmm. together and be there for each other, especially too when I'm thinking about just Medicaid, the future of Medicaid for a lot of people. A lot of people are going to need care. So, you know, you all traveled from Pasadena to Mendocino County. And so you visited several communities. So it was a lot of walking. You didn't walk all of it, but there was a lot of walking. Again, like I said, you all have to see the film because it reminds you how beautiful California is. We live in such a beautiful state. So along your journey, you engage with people who are doing the work of caring, right? They're helping unhoused folks. They're working with farm communities. They're reclaiming land taken from their ancestors. What did you learn about this? Another term I want to talk to you about, radical survival, along with radical care, when looking at these groups of people that you all engaged with?
Oh, I love this question because there's really something key about that choice and the creation of this project. What we knew from all the collaborations and partnerships that we've had over the years, because, you know, People's Kitchen has existed in one form or another since 2007. And what we have witnessed and been a part of is that the work is being done of survival. The work is being done of, as you characterize, radical care. It's simply that we need more opportunities to witness it, to experience it real time in place. And so we selected these five regions to do our approximation of this long walk north that's in the book, to go to people in their place to experience and get the benefit and privilege of you know, the work that they're doing that is already about surviving together. Mm-hmm. There's no need to recreate a wheel. It's happening. And so for us to have an opportunity to go to place, to people, to record these experiences, and, you know, our filmmaker, Fox Nakai, was embedded with us this entire time. This was over a 3-month period that we did this journey. Mm-hmm. And we were able to do something incredibly powerful, which is for us to witness this mycelium network of survival and care that already exists, so that we are almost like... we're only stand-ins for everyone else. Like, we're probably 6 to 12 people on each part of the journey. And we are only manifestations of everyone else that's watching the film or having this experience of waking up to what is needed for survival with one another. And it is a powerful thing to witness and to integrate these practices into our life once witnessed, and see it that way, more specifically. Keep going. Yeah.
And give some examples of what you saw as far as examples of radical survival, which, like, I was watching, I was like, this is not radical. This is things that my grandparents and great-grandparents did, right?
Yeah.
But I know today would be seen as radical. What were some of the things that you took away with?
You know, I think that's a really good point. And I'm actually from Kansas. My people are from Mississippi and Kentucky. So I feel you. Right. Like, there's something really original that's experienced in this. And I think what is clear is that when you see, you know, folks in LA that are working with houseless communities, providing shelter or food, when you see a group in Watsonville of farm workers whose land is being taken away from them so they cannot provide in the way that they want for their own families, the way that they're providing for the entire United States, you know, the produce that they're working these fields for. Like, you see the context of the action that is, like you said, you know, it's something that we are familiar with from our historical and cultural background. But when you see it in modern context to the real blocks to being able to live in a way that is in alignment with what we say is, you know, what we want to be as human beings in this world, that's when you see these strategies come out. That's when you see, okay, we are going to call on our neighbors to protest this illegal eviction. We're going to create solidarity in this moment to provide food for this community that's in need. This is all considered mutual aid. This is all considered movement work and activism. But when you see it in that interpersonal scale, when you see those very specific stories play out in very specific regions and see that, you know, there is a system in place for care to happen at the worst and best of times, the radical part for me is that we are there with them. The radical part for me is that we get that invitation in the midst of those tragedies. Because, you know, one of the things that happened is the Pajaro Valley, there was the levee break right before we were going through that region. And we said, is it really the right time to do this? Or Tulare Lake was came back, you know, from being extinct, right? All this was happening during this walk. And we said, is it still appropriate for us to come? You all are going through so much. Like, how can we support? And they said to us each time, we want you here. We want to be witnessed. We want to be in community in this moment because we know that's the thing that will make us be in a place of being able to survive. So there isn't this boundary of when is or isn't good to be up in each other's business. That's the radical part.
Yeah. And I'm thinking, too, is, you know, the storytelling, right? You know, I'm thinking because that's what I do. I'm a storyteller. The storytelling, the food, the layout that you all had, how sitting at the table, sitting at the table, eating dinner, making fresh tortillas. Like, I mean, they picked the corn off the stalks and ground it and having fresh tortillas and sitting outside and, you know, and in the sun or, you know, in the moonlight and eating. And there was scenes of going to the elders and, you know, getting advice for, you know, from the young people seeking elders for advice of, you know, of their wellness and the spiritual wellness. And I love the scene where you all were in, I think, San Joaquin Valley, and it wasn't safe for people of color to kind of roam around. So you all like got together as a group and bicycled together. I mean, just those little things. And yeah, again, going back to like, you know, checking in on each other and, you know, it's not the right time to mind your own business. When it's, you know, when it's people that need help and assistance. If you're just tuning in, I'm chatting with Jocelyn Jackson, co-founder of People's Kitchen Collective. Her documentary Earthseed is screening Sunday, July 27th at BAMFA, which stands for the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive. I can't believe I only have 4 more minutes left, but, you know, I wanted to ask you too about the food, and I know I brought this up. The food was so beautiful, and I know that's definitely something that's very much a part of your activism. And you were all welcome to these communities with beautiful, like, organic meals, the colors, and oh, y'all was sitting out in the forest eating. It was just so beautiful. How does food play a role in this idea of care and social justice?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that too, because, you know, the co-founders of People's Kitchen Collective are Saqib Kaval, Sita Kuratomi Bomek, and myself. And we have this whole crew of people that have been riding and dying with us with the last many years that were part of this walk. And our tradition together is to cook together and to be of service to the people through food. That's our original instructions for ourselves as far as how we tell our stories, how we create calls to action. That's how we make sure that there is a real opportunity for people to settle in to what is being said about what is important for us to tend to as a community. We know that sitting at the table is a very important way for us to have those conversations that can take root in a way that's not possible if you're, in those other modes. I love all the modes. Don't get me wrong. Like, I love them. But ours is this one specifically, because if you're sharing a meal about, for example, we did a meal about Japanese internment camps and how very similar it was to the executive order that created the Muslim ban, back a few years ago. And if you have people sitting at a table eating these very relevant dishes like sukiyaki or, all these dishes that we have at the table, you're able to internalize this information and take it to heart and feel it in an emotional way that gets us to that place of taking agency. And so in this film, when we're eating that rabbit stew that's mentioned in the book,
yes,
or we're eating the meals that are created by our community partners or by the trail angels that brought us food, these are very specific acts of sharing love, care, hospitality, but it's also an opportunity for everyone watching to see that there is always an entry point and an opportunity for people to express survival to one another through these foodways that all of us are familiar with, whether we have access to them or not. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for us to use that language, always using that language of food to make sure the story can be heard, feels like just such a gift. And we don't take it lightly how important it is for us to keep doing that when we can be forgetful about all these traditions that are the original instructions for us to survive.
So, Joss, we have really a few seconds left.
Yeah.
I know it went by so quick. What are some things people can start doing now as we prepare? Like I said, I'm concerned about Medicaid. A lot of people are going to lose Medicaid. So we're going to see a lot of people that need support. What can we start doing now to build our communities, to connect?
Yes. And when you come to the screening, we're going to do a screening guide and a program that has a lot of these next steps. And it really does start where you're talking about. People who are differently abled, who have health issues, start there. Walk in your communities or in your families or in your neighborhoods. Find out who has the greatest needs. Start there and see, have those communications, have those conversations about what is it that you need? What is it that I can offer and vice versa? Practice reciprocity. Get the information that's really going to be the most important when these moments of harsh realities start to strike. And don't be afraid of it. Be in the joy of caring for one another. Love the process of being radically hospitable to one another, because it is absolutely our gift as human beings to know that our souls still work, that our hearts can be that expansive.
All right, Joss, we have to go. Thank you so much. All right, so y'all check out the film Earthseed. Jocelyn Jackson's co-founder of People's Kitchen Collective. And again, you can watch the documentary Earthseed. It'll be screaming at BAMFA in Berkeley on Sunday, July 27th. And coming up, rising rents and high bridge tolls. An Oakland horror writer tells stories about how just trying to make it in the Bay Area is scarier than the monsters under our beds. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darden. The Sights and Sounds team, kicked off our summer at one of my favorite events, the Bay Area Book Festival. And we interviewed a couple of writers. One of them is Cynthia Gomez. She writes horror and speculative fiction set in Oakland, and much of her work is about resistance to oppression. Her first book is a collection of short stories called The Nightmare Box and Other Stories. Her story about a Latina vampire trying to survive in expensive gentrified Oakland really intrigued me, and I'm thinking about the Earthseed interview prior. It's all about surviving. I spoke with Cynthia Gomez outside in downtown Berkeley. So I am here outside in downtown Berkeley with author Cynthia Gomez. Hey, Cynthia.
Hi, how are you? How are you both?
We're good. Our wonderful producer, Sights and Sounds producer, Porphyria Rangel, is here as well. So, we went to your panel about Latino horror. I try to say all the names. And it's such an interesting time with horror right now. Just, I think, in the last several years, as far as we're seeing more people of color, more people from marginalized communities getting platforms and more attention about horror, even though we know folks from those communities have been writing horror
telling horror stories for a long time. So, but this is your first book, right?
It is.
Yes. So how does it feel? I mean, the Bay Area Book Festival is huge. How does it feel being a new author here?
It feels really fantastic.
So, okay, so your new book, The Nightmare Box and Other Stories, is set in Oakland, or largely set in Oakland in the Bay Area. It's really interesting. I haven't read all the book. I read the first story, but it's just really, it's a different experience reading horror. It's always cool to read a story, just whatever genre, in the Bay Area at home. Why Oakland? Why? What is about Oakland as far as being a great place to tell horror?
So partly why Oakland is because I'm a Bay Area kid and my family has deep roots in the Bay Area. So I know this place very well. I know the trees, I know the stories, I know a lot of the history, and I've got an emotional connection to these places. And I feel like that's going to make for stronger fiction, right? For stronger stories when it's something that the author is connected to. So that's a good part of it. But the other is that when I first started writing fiction, and the first piece that I had published, I actually didn't set it in Oakland, even though I was living in Oakland at the time, because I thought Oakland is not that well known. People aren't going to want to connect to it. I should set it in a bigger city where it'll have more residents. And then I decided that was ridiculous. And now instead I do the reverse. Now instead I choose to set everything in Oakland, or almost everything in Oakland, or have an Oakland connection, precisely because I didn't think it was important enough. So that became kind of my fun challenge. And because of that fun challenge, it actually has led me to doing all kinds of research into Oakland history and all this fantastic. I mean, Oakland has so much rich history, right? It's the Bay Area is the birth of the free speech movement. It's the birth of, the fights for ethnic studies. The Panthers were founded not too far from here, where we're sitting in Berkeley. They were founded in Oakland. There's all these artists who live here. There are all these neighborhoods that are some of the most diverse in the country. So there's just so much rich stuff to pull from and so much stuff to make great story out of.
So when you're out and about as a writer, like maybe you see something, like you may see like a puddle of red fluid on the ground. Does a story come to your mind? Like, ooh, that could be something creepy to write about.
It does. The short answer is it does. Not necessarily objects, but definitely places that just look like there's something weird or fishy there, right? Or places where I know that there's actually history and I think I want to tell that history, you know, like particular pieces of ground where significant stuff happened.
You could write nonfiction, you could write literary fiction, whatever category, but you choose horror as your vessel to address social issues. Why horror?
So the first answer is because it's fun. We love vampires. Everybody's got different tastes, right? But I love slasher movies. I love vampires. I love ghosts. When I was a kid, I first started reading Roald Dahl when I was like 8 and 9 years old. And he writes about witches and grandmas that grow 20 feet tall. That's really fun, right? All kinds of potions and magic and, you know, the chocolate factory. So that was what I started with. And it's what's always really, really fun for me. And that's the strongest reason. You know, for a long time, I did try to write more traditional literary fiction. And I kept having these stories that were like partway finished and I never finished them. And the first time I ever finished something, sent it in and had it published, it was because I said, let me just try something. Let me try writing a little bit like a Stephen King story. And it was about someone who moves into a new apartment and she puts her photographs on the wall that she's taken, and something happens to the person who's in this one picture. Whatever she places in this one particular spot where the light hits a little funny, something happens to the person in that picture. So that's classically speculative, right? That doesn't happen in real life. And it was like a door opening for me that I can actually write this stuff that's really fun and like that's hidden inside our world, that's behind our world, that's underneath our world, that's underneath the bed. And that's just the kind of stuff that makes my heart beat faster.
You said on the panel that one of the monsters in your work is guilt. Which I noticed too with the vampire too as well. Talk about that, because guilt can do some damage.
guilt can absolutely do some damage. And the awful thing about guilt is that it's, so I gave this sentiment to a character in the next book that I have coming out, because sometimes I can make my characters be wiser than I am. And so this one character says about guilt, she says, you know, it's like fear. It's supposed to guide you to something. You're not supposed to carry it around like a millstone. And again, she's wiser than I am, because I can recognize intellectually that it would be awfully nice not to carry around guilt, but that doesn't change anything about the fact that it lives with me all the time, always looking over my shoulder. It's in my head. It's like, is this the right thing to think? You know, should I have acted differently with that person? Should I have been more compassionate to that person? You know, should I have given that person more? Am I being selfish? Am I being broad-minded enough? And it's why I think we like writing about ghosts and hauntings, because it's kind of another way to think about guilt, right? Is something that won't leave, even if it's, you know, past its time, you know, it served its purpose, but it's still hanging around. Like, there's a lot of ghosts and haunting commonality with that. So I think writing about ghosts and hauntings is kind of a good way to, I would say it's a good way to exercise fear, but the guilt comes back. So it's a way of temporarily pushing the guilt away for a little bit.
You know, what I noticed about your work and so many other horror writers is that the monster is not usually the monster. And you bring up issues, you know, that are deep. Like in the, like I won't, like I said, I only read the first story, which was the vampire story. I mean, and I was thinking, she's a vampire and she got to deal with gentrification, high cost of living in the Bay Area, high cost of Ryan Bart, but I was even thinking food insecurity. She can't even just have like affordable living. And I just thought that was deep.
So I love that that's, for one thing, I don't think it's possible to think too deeply about a story, but the reason why I wrote even that one is for exactly the vampire story is for exactly that reason, because I love a vampire story, and yet they're always rich. They're always, not almost always, but almost always white. And I thought about, so there's a backstory to the vampire story that I kind of enjoy telling. So my day job is where I work for a labor union. And a couple years ago, I was working on this database that calculates seniority. Like someone's been working at their job 5 years and 3 months or whatever it is. And I made a mistake where when I added a bunch of people, it gave them, instead of like 12 years of seniority, it gave them 300 years of seniority. And I made a joke about how, as far as I know, our union doesn't actually represent any vampires. But that got me thinking, wait a minute, what about a vampire union? Like, what would they agitate for? And then that got me thinking about, well, what would a working class vampire have to deal with that a rich vampire, conveniently in stories, doesn't have to deal with? They would still have to deal with housing. Right. And one of the saddest things about the character who chooses to become a vampire is because she's like, well, now I don't have to worry about paying for rent and food in the same month. Right. So the way that she deals with the real issue of food insecurity is by depriving herself of the ability to ever enjoy food again.
I mean, that hurt when I read that. It's a good story, but I said, wow. But that's the way the world is right now. And living in the Bay Area where people are going to extremes to survive, it speaks to really what's happening today. And I know, too, there's an issue in that story with sexual harassment, too, as well. It's steamy, too, because it's a vampire. So
the very first line of that vampire story goes, the first thing Viviana noticed on her first night as a vampire was how much she wanted to f*** everyone. So yes, there's also some joy, which is, I think, a lot of, you were asking earlier, like what makes a good horror story? It's not necessary that a horror story involve joy, because sometimes it just doesn't, but it's kind of nice and it plays against the terrors. If there's also some steaminess, some like wonderful descriptions of food, but people having a good old time and some humor to play off of the terrors and the gore and the blood.
You know, I'm thinking of Sinners, of course. I mean, right now, as we're talking about this, Sinners is like, I think they made over 300 million globally. I'm thinking of Mexican Gothic, which is a huge, very, very well-respected, huge hit that's a novel. And I'm just thinking about how we're seeing more diversity in horror, even though, again, as I said before, we're from diverse backgrounds, have been writing, imagining, storytelling horror for generations. What do you think, what's the significance of horror now, just in light of what's happening in the country, what's happening in the world, and to see this emergence of, like, again, big, you know, big works like Sinners, like Get Out, like Mexican Gothic?
So I love all three of those. I've just seen Sinners for the second time. I'm going to go see it a third time. I feel like, for one thing, the lesson I hope gets learned from the fact that so many people love Sinners is not the wrong lesson that some, probably mostly white decision makers, learned from Get Out. Because after Get Out, what you saw happening at least a little bit was some people thought that the lesson was, oh, okay, right? And produce more movies where white racists are the enemy. I don't think that was the lesson to have been learned from Get Out. I think the lesson to learn from Get Out and Sinners is hire marginalized creators, give them everything that they need, and then get the hell out of their way. So that's why Sinners is fantastic, because Ryan Coogler is extremely talented, and he was able to make a movie that was extremely meaningful to him. And I don't imagine, and I hope he wasn't told all the time, you know, by the studio, this is what you need to do instead to be more palatable. So I feel like that's, you know, when horror can do really well is when it's just let creative people have the resources that they need to tell stories that are extremely meaningful to them, and then by extension the audience, because again, that's why we love stories like Get Out and Mexican Gothic and Sinners, is because ultimately, you know, these creators were making something that meant a whole lot to them. So let's have that. And you asked, like, what horror can mean right now. I mean, we could have books full of essays that would talk about that. A couple years ago, I remember saying, we're in a golden age of horror right now because we're in a golden age of horror.
Do you scare yourself when you're writing?
Well, I can provoke a lot of emotions in myself when I'm writing. I will write stuff that does move me to tears, and that's always my sign of, okay, that's the direction I should go in then. You know, or stuff that makes me kind of swell with joy when I think about this character finally getting to have the outcome that I want for them. But the one emotion that I don't seem to be able to provoke in myself so far is fear. It's kind of like tickling yourself, right? It would be awfully nice if we could have that, but I can't seem to scare myself in that way.
Well, Cynthia, I appreciate you for taking the time to talk to us. Cynthia Gomez, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
That was author Cynthia Gomez. Her book, The Nightmare Box and Other Stories, is available in bookstores now. Next up, an author inspired by her grandkid co-writes a children's book about the challenges of moving. Keep it locked right here. Janae Darden. We're continuing sharing our coverage of the Bay Area Book Festival. Summertime is a busy season for moving, and for kids, it can be hard to leave behind their neighbors in school. Stephanie Wildman and Adam R. Chang write about this in the children's book, Mary's Moving Day. So Mary is a little biracial girl who is sad to be moving out of her Chinese grandparents' home. But both her Chinese grandparents and Jewish grandparents do what they can to make her know everything will be all right. And they gift her with items from both cultures to make her feel secure. Adam R. Chang wasn't able to make the book festival, but the Sights and Sounds team watched co-writer Stephanie give a reading to kids at the Berkeley Central Library's Children's Floor. And those kids were having a ball at the festival. You'll be able to hear in the background. But afterwards, we spoke with Stephanie Wildman about the book.
Hi, everybody. I'm Stephanie Wildman. Raise your hand if you have a grandma or a grandpa. Okay? A lot of people. So in this book, we're going to learn what might be a couple of new words for grandma or grandpa. So Mary has a Chinese grandma and grandpa, and the grandpa is Ye Ye, and the grandma is Mama. And she also has a Jewish grandma and grandpa, and the grandpa is Zadie, and the grandma is Bubby. Okay, so Mary's moving day. This year, I'm almost as tall as the stone lions in front of my apartment building. Why do we have to move? I've lived here my whole life. My mom and dad work hard. They leave early in the morning and come home late at night to tuck me in. My grandparents, Mama and Yaya, and the Chinese stone lions in front of my building take care of me after school. Mama makes me delicious picnics.
Stephanie, it's nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too.
And so we're talking about your book, Miri's Moving Day. We just heard you read here at the Bay Area Book Festival in the Berkeley Public Library, in the main library. And the book is inspired by one of your grandchildren?
That's right. I have four grandchildren, and all of my books are in some way inspired by questions they ask. And Miri came about because one of my grandchildren asked, "Can I be Chinese and Jewish?" He asked at the dinner table. And his father said, "Yes, because you are." But that made me realize that there have to be other children wondering the same thing, and they're not seeing themselves represented in books. And I knew Adam. We had done some writing together before in the legal field.
And you're talking about Adam R. Chang, the co-author.
My co-author, Adam Chang, and the book is illustrated by Dream Chen, because it's a picture book. I think it's always important to say the illustrator's name, because it wouldn't be a book without the illustrations, too, the words and the illustrations. But anyway, we talked about it, and that's how Miri came about.
So what prompted your grandchild to ask that question, if they could be both? Was it like... Did somebody at school say he had to pick one, or was...
You know, we did not at dinner ask him why he asked. I think he was 4 years old at the time. It seemed to me to be, you know, a question he was just thinking about, looking around at who's at the table and, you know, just wondering. You know, it just made us think that other children might have the same wondering.
Yeah. Yeah, because when you're a kid, questions just come up. Yeah, just... as you're trying to figure out yourself and the world.
Well, one of my other books, which is called Ghost Rider, was prompted by a grandson. Every time I would call for months, he would say, "Grandma, did you know Julio died?" Julio was their pet dog. It was a Boston Terrier. And I finally, you know, after multiple times of this, I realized he's trying to process that loss. Mm-hmm. And so that's how that book came about, you know, realizing that there was a need.
Yeah. Now, your co-author, Adam R. Chang, you all have a history, not just with writing. How did you all meet?
So I was lucky enough to be invited to teach at summer school at the University of Hawaii, Richardson School of Law. Adam, if he were here, could tell you the year. I'm not sure I can get it right, but it was a while ago. And I taught a summer class in law and social justice, and he was a student in that class. And he's from the Bay Area. He grew up here. So we stayed in touch after I came back to California. And at some point, he invited me to work with him to do a presentation for the Asian American Bar Association about gender. And I went to have lunch with him to tell him no, because I was so busy. I was a law professor at the time. I had a full teaching load. I had writing commitments. It was crazy. And I ended up saying yes, because I adore him. And so we did this presentation, and it was really well received. The people at the Bar Association were like, "You really should write this up." And so we did write an article about gender, and we even did a presentation at the Law and Society Association. So we did have a history of working together. So it was kind of natural when this question came up from my grandson to brainstorm with Adam.
And you talk about being a professor. You're also a professor emeritus at Santa Clara University School of Law. Yeah. So we got two lawyers writing this.
The state bar would want me to tell you I am not a lawyer anymore. They you take retired status or inactive status at the bar, and so I cannot represent myself as a lawyer, but I say I was trained as a lawyer.
Okay. We want to get it right, because she knows the law. You know, some themes I caught in the book. First, about Miri, she's moving, and she's kind of not too crazy about it because she doesn't want to leave her grandparents because her parents, they, you know, live with the grandparents. And I was thinking about how, you know, it's mentioned in the book that her parents work a lot. And so, like a lot of parents do. And so she sees her grandparents more than she sees her parents. Yeah.
And that was true of Adam. If he were here, he would tell you that. His mama and Yaya, who we saw in the pictures at the end on the slides.
And mama and Yaya is Kenny's for grandpa.
Uh-huh. Right.
Yeah. So that's where that comes from. So that's how he contributed kind of to the storyline. That was inspired by his own experience.
Exactly.
I related to that too because my mother is a single parent. And I spent a lot of time with my grandparents. So I related to Mary, you know, in that extent. And I would be sad too if I had to leave. And I know the cooking was good because can't nobody cook like grandma and grandpa.
and the book really is about the big feelings that come up with a big change like this, like moving. And so she does start out feeling sad. And hopefully the reader comes along as the book builds to get a little excited.
Yeah, because, you know, moving is hard for kids. And I'm thinking
it is
hard for everybody. Because I'm thinking right now it's summertime, it's almost the beginning of summer as we're talking. And this is a very popular time when people move. So a lot of little kids may be having some feelings right now because they may have to move and transfer schools and leave their, you know, neighbors. And so that can be hard for a child. Yeah, yeah. And she's leaving, you know, grandma and grandpa, even though she's not going too far. And then also definitely another theme in the book is culture. She had wanting to embrace both sides. And I love that, and let me see what I wrote it down, the names of the mezuzah. And can you explain what that is for listeners?
Sure. So what most people call a mezuzah is actually a mezuzah case. What you see hanging at an angle on the doorpost of a Jewish house or a synagogue is the case that holds the mezuzah. The mezuzah is actually a scroll, usually sanctified by a rabbi, and I did pass around an unkosher sample. It contains a very prominent Jewish prayer called the Shema, and it basically blesses the house. So you have the mezuzah, which is the scroll that you roll up, and you put in the mezuzah case, and that's what they hang at the end of the story. But as a shorthand, people often just say the mezuzah. You know, I'll tap the mezuzah as I go in and out. But it's really the case that they're tapping. So that might be too much inside baseball conversation.
And you're Jewish?
I am Jewish.
No, I think that's good to learn. And then there's the guardian lions that are and people that may know, those stone lions that we see sometimes in front of people's houses or I guess on gates that in Chinese culture. And that's for protection too, right?
Right. And so sometimes they're called foo dogs. We tried to call them Asian lions to be more inclusive because many Asian cultures have them, but in this case, because they're Chinese, I think the editors made it say Chinese lions. And I love, there's a picture at the end of the book in the back matter of one of these lion heads that you often see like in a Chinese New Year's parade or Lunar New Year's parade. And I learned from Adam, who had been a lion in those parades, that if you see this figure with the head and 4 feet, it's representing the lion. But when you see that same head, but there are multiple feet, it's a dragon.
Okay. So that's all good to know. We'll take those mental notes. But I love that she has, you know, she's getting protection and blessings from both sides. Because, something I know from my culture sometimes we'll say is nothing like a grandmother's prayer, you know, that protection. And so I thought that was beautiful that both her grandparents are using their cultural backgrounds and combining them and kind of blessing her and protecting her. Yeah.
Thank you. No, that's one of the things I think that Adam and I felt strongly about in this book was to show a happy family. I mean, they're all supporting each other. Yes, they have their differences, but they are melding together. And a lot of depictions show conflict. And of course, there's more story in conflict, but I think there's story here too.
Yeah. And Mary's a lucky kid.
Thank you so much, Stephanie.
Oh, thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
That was children's book author Stephanie Wildman, and her book is called Mary's Moving Day, and it's available in bookstores now. And I don't want to get in trouble with my mama, so my mama could cook too. I know I said nobody can cook like grandma and grandpa. I do not want to get in trouble. That's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with Janae Darden. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, our board operator, Tariq Ansari, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And thank you for tuning in. Okay. Here's some things to do for the weekend. The play Aslan has been extended, and this is the last week to see it. I saw it on Sunday at the Magic Theater in Fort Mason, and it is powerful. Shout out to KLW DJ One Way Possible, who was awesome on stage. And you can listen to my past interviews with the playwright and actors to learn more about the play. Next weekend, July 25th to the 26th, Oakland's Beast Crawl is hosting a series of readings and fundraisers to keep the literary festival going, and it's called Beast Aid, and the readings will be at Chapter 510, Department of Make-Believe in Oakland. SF Hip Hop Festival is this Saturday at the Midway, and the headliners include Souls of Mischief, Digable Planets, and The Dog Pound. Before that, on Friday, there will be a symposium on hip-hop and AI featuring the one and only hip-hop legend Rakim, who is also performing at Yoshi's tomorrow night, and there are still tickets left. And shout out to KLW's Hana Baba, who will be performing at San Francisco Story Fest on July 19th. My birthday is this week, so definitely treat yourself in my honor and do something fun, do something loving on yourself, do something positive, eat something good. We'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other.